Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. This morning, the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act in a 5-4 decision. The 1996 DOMA denied benefits to married same-sex couples, defining marriage as between a man and a woman. Speaking for the majority, Justice Anthony Kennedy said DOMA was unconstitutional because it violated the right to liberty and to equal protection for gay couples. It's been a big week for the U.S. Supreme Court. Yesterday, the court struck down key provisions of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, freeing 9 states with a history of discrimination to change voting laws without federal approval. Chief Justice John Roberts said the country has changed. Critics like Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. and the nation's commitment to justice had been disserved by today's decision. So what do these historic decisions mean for us as a society, for civil rights? And what do they tell us about the direction of the Supreme Court? Joining us to talk about all of this is Kate Kendall, who is Executive Director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights. Hi, Kate.
Good morning.
And Brenton Mock, who is a journalist for Color Lines, and he focuses on covering voting rights. Hi, Brenton.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so before we start our discussion, let's listen in at San Francisco City Hall this morning as people gathered to hear the decision.
It wasn't just interest. It was a true commitment to equality that brought us here. It was the extraordinary leadership of many folks in this room, so many of you out there in the audience. So I just want to celebrate your wisdom, your faith, your devotion as well to this cause, and to thank you for, and I'll close, for participating in this remarkable journey that we are still on. This sweeping journey. And like any journey, it's not linear. It's messy. It's complex. There are good days and bad days, but it's a worthy journey that we're on. And it's a journey that inspires. It doesn't coerce. We're not motivated by this cause of equality. We're inspired by it because it's a fundamental principle that defines the best of who we are, our human dignity, our self-worth, our humanity. So thank you all very much for your extraordinary work. And congratulations on this special day. Thank you.
And that was Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom speaking at San Francisco City Hall this morning as the DOMA decision from the Supreme Court came down. It was former Mayor Gavin Newsom who began issuing marriage licenses to gay couples in February of 2004. And Kate, you were there this morning using some colorful language that we will not be able to repeat because of FCC rules. But tell us a little bit about the celebration this morning, Kate.
Well, let me just first say, I actually regret using that colorful language. I don't know what I was thinking. It's just, you know, it's been a 9-year fight here and sort of got overtaken a little bit, but I do regret that. It was a poor choice.
And just for our audience, essentially rhymes with duck, Proposition 8.
It was pretty much telling, it was how I felt about Prop 8. So it was a good riddance sort of thing for Prop 8.
Very good. Okay, well, let's reconstitute it as good riddance, Prop 8. How's
there
that?
There you go. That's what I'll remember. That's what I'll do the rest of the day. And, you know, I mean, I feel like Prop 8 and DOMA both are such stigmatizing laws. And, you know, they really do, you know, mark same-sex couples and LGBT people generally as really outside the bounds of civil society. And they promote private prejudice. They provide cover for people's private prejudice and bigotry. Why should anyone support equality or dignity or justice for same-sex couples when the government themselves itself discriminates? So having these laws gone, at least as to Section 3 of DOMA, federal recognition, and have Prop 8 gone, is really an important catalytic moment. It's not everything we should have gotten. It's not everything we wanted. But we are very close to the day when the government will no longer be in the business of active discrimination against LGBT people.
Well, let's break some of this down, Kate, and you are a lawyer. Prop 8 is not necessarily gone. Can you explain exactly what the justice's decision in kicking it back to the courts in California means?
Well, I think it is gone, but I understand what you're saying. It's a little more technical. They didn't rule on the merits of Prop 8. the merits ruling would have been, yes, we find Prop 8 is unconstitutional under the federal constitution. That's not what they found. What they found instead, and how they ruled, was that the proponents of Prop 8, the folks who put it on the ballot, did not have standing to defend Prop 8 once the state of California didn't want to defend Prop 8. And standing is a kind of an arcane thing, but it's important. It's why, you know, some person just can't randomly sue you. You have to show you have a specific injury to have standing in court to bring a case or to prosecute a case or to defend a law. You have to show that you are going to be harmed if the law is not defended. And the proponents, other than not liking gay people and not wanting gay people to get married, couldn't show any specific harm. And so I think it's the right ruling that the proponents did not have standing. And what that means is the decision reverts back to Vaughn Walker's district court ruling. But, of course, let's keep in mind, Vaughn Walker's district court ruling, a very lengthy, beautiful opinion, struck down Prop 8 as a violation of the 14th Amendment to the federal Constitution. And that that ruling is now the law of the case. That's now the governing law. And that applies statewide because the state was a party. The state of California was sued. And in 25 days, once the opinion is certified from the Supreme Court, I am very confident that couples will be able to marry in couples will be able to marry and will be marrying in every single county in California.
So, but Prop 8 proponents have 25 days to appeal this. Is that accurate?
No, there's no more appeal. They're done. We have the last word, which is the Supreme Court. The only thing they could do is perhaps persuade a county clerk to not do their job. A county clerk who says, look, I don't want to issue marriage licenses to gay people. But, you know, the county clerk's taken oath to uphold the laws of California, and the law of California now will be, in 25 days, that same-sex couples are permitted to get marriage licenses just like anybody else. And if that county clerk doesn't want to do their job, well, then they can go find another job, but they can't be a county clerk if they're not going to abide by the law.
Our
opponents could represent one of those people, and there could be some little case that, you know, tries to fight that, but it's not going to go anywhere.
So let me read to you from a press release from the Proposition 8 Legal Defense Fund. They say, we are pleased that the Supreme Court has reversed the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals' misguided decision that sought to invalidate Proposition 8.
Well, you know, that is a really good, clever way to try to make lemonade out of lemons for them, because the Ninth Circuit decision ruled on the merits. The Prop 8 was unconstitutional on the merits, and that's not what the Supreme Court reached. But the practical effect of finding that the proponents did not have standing is exactly the same. This is a statewide ruling. Vaughn Walker's ruling applies. Prop 8 was found unconstitutional by him. That's now the authoritative, definitive ruling on Prop 8, and you know, we will have marriage again in California in 25 days.
And so explain then the DOMA ruling, which is a fairly narrow ruling.
The DOMA ruling is narrow, but it's enormously important. And the DOMA ruling was on the merits. That is an opinion authored by Justice Kennedy. And what he found was that Section 3 of DOMA, the section that denies federal recognition and benefits to otherwise validly married same-sex couples. So these are couples who are married in their state. The state has no problem. The state is giving them benefits. And yet the federal government, while recognizing every other married couple in that state, does not recognize this particular couple or any same-sex couple because of Section 3 of DOMA. And Justice Kennedy found that that violates the liberty provisions of the Fifth Amendment, which applies to the federal government. You know, the 14th Amendment sort of applies to the states. The Fifth Amendment applies to the federal government. And what Kennedy found is that by DOMA denies liberty without due process to same-sex couples because it denies them the very same recognition that every other married couple gets. So it's enormously important, the ruling. It doesn't strike down all of DOMA. There's another section of DOMA that allows states to not recognize each other's marriages.
Right, so the 38 states that do not recognize same-sex marriage still have the right to do that.
They still have the right to do that, and that's going to be our work going forward. You know, we can't leave anyone behind. We're 50 different states, but we're one country, and everyone should be protected equally and, you know, sort of be able to take a deep breath that they, who they are, is respected under the law, and we're not there yet.
So, but tell me where we are here in California. If you're married, what does this concretely mean for you? What changes today?
Well, if you're married, if you were one of the 18,000 couples that got married during that window before Prop 8 passed, you've always been married. If you seek to get married in 25 days, you will be married just like your neighbors, just like your parents were married, just like anybody else is married in California. And that marriage now and the 18,000 couples who got married have federal recognition and security as well, because California recognizes your marriage and the federal government recognizes your marriage. The one area that is still going to be a subject of future litigation and perhaps executive action by the Obama administration is for couples who are married but they live in a state that does not recognize their marriage, the 37 states you were talking about. In those states, some of them will have federal recognition depending on the federal benefit or the federal law, but many of them will not have a host of federal benefits, including, for example, Social Security survivors benefits. That's a statutory thing that the administration can't change. Congress would have to change that to recognize same-sex couples. So we're still living in a house divided in this country, and we're still in a situation where some same-sex couples will be the haves. Those will be, they'll have a huge number of benefits and recognition because they live in states that recognize their marriages, and same-sex couples who will be in the have-not category, who have very minimal protections under state law, including no recognition of their marriage, which means they'll have some federal benefits but not all. So, you know, this is by no means the last chapter in this story. But it's a very important chapter as we move forward.
Well, and speaking of this idea of a house divided, I want to get into the Voting Rights Act decision yesterday that came down and kind of contrast these two decisions and see what they mean in terms of civil rights, in terms of how our society is changing. But before I do that, I want to ask both of you, and I believe we're also joined by Robert Rubin, who is a civil rights attorney in San Francisco. Did these decisions surprise any of you? Go ahead and start, Kate.
Well, you know, I wasn't surprised by the rulings on DOMA and Prop 8. We sort of predicted, and so did many watchers, that this was the way it was going to come down. Obviously, it's a huge sense of relief to have it ratified. I am very concerned about some of the other rulings from the court. The ruling yesterday on the Voting Rights Act is terrible. And it portends very, very bad things for all of us in this country. And, of course, LGBT people are in every single population and, you know, live in states where voting rights could be restricted, particularly among LGBT people of color.
Well, then, Kate, let's table the surprise for just a moment. Yeah. And let me bring Brenton in as well as Robert to explain what the Voting Rights Act decision really means. Can you break it down for us, Brenton? Are you there?
Well, yeah, I'm here. Basically, what Chief Justice Roberts said was that we can continue to have the cake, which would be Section 5, but we can no longer use the ingredients traditionally used to make that cake. We can't use the sugar, the eggs, or the flour. And by that, I mean he struck the Section 4 coverage formula. That was the formula created by Congress that basically determined where Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act would be applied, and those places are the places that have historically had brutal racial discrimination when it came to voting against people of color and also people for whom English is their second language. So,
Let me clarify. So that's Alabama, Alaska, is there Arizona, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, and Virginia, and also counties and municipalities in other places like Brooklyn, Manhattan, and the Bronx, and here in California, Monterey, Yuba, and Kings County.
Right. And then New Hampshire was actually on that list up until this year. They've now been bailed out. But yes.
Okay, so what happens now? How has this decision changed voting rights?
Well, basically what the court did was they kicked it to Congress to come up with a new formula. And this was really controversial because the court kind of assumed that Congress didn't do its due diligence when it came up with the formula that was prevailing. And that wasn't the case. There were months and months and months of hearings in Congress. There were 15,000 pages of evidence brought forth of racial discrimination in the areas that were covered by Section 5. They definitely studied this comprehensively before they allowed that formula to stand. But the Supreme Court basically said, well, we just don't believe you, and we're going to substitute our opinion for yours and say that now you have to go back and come up with a brand new formula to cover different areas in the United States.
And Chief Justice John Roberts said, well, you know, you're using 1970s criteria and the country has changed. What's your reaction to that?
I think that Justice Roberts had a prejudice against Voting Rights Act. He had been trying to fight to gut that the Voting Rights Act since the 1980s when he worked for the Reagan administration. But he never really had a clear understanding of how that formula acted. It wasn't just based off of voter registration and turnout rates from the 1970s. It was also based upon issues of voter dilution and what's called the second generation voter obstructions, where people would gerrymander, state legislators would gerrymander and do these redistricting plans that would effectively not allow people of color to be able to elect candidates of their own choice. But he just completely disregarded all of that. He disregarded the fact that places that have had a clean history could be bailed out of Section 5. He also disregarded the fact that places with new or that actually had present-day voting problems could be bailed into Section 5.
And you said, Brenton, that this was a devastating decision, but it could have been way worse.
It could have been. I mean, to use my analogy from earlier, he could have just taken the entire cake away, which is Section 5. And it was really Section 5 that was before the court, and he really didn't challenge that. But had they said that Section 5 itself was unconstitutional, then, you know, no African-Americans or people of color in any state or locality ever would have been able to been protected from discrimination because, just, you know, there would have been a permanent erasure of the that watchdog provision of Section 5, which made states pre-clear any election law change before the federal government to make sure that no racial disenfranchisement happened, either through intention or even by mistake. But Section 5 was preserved. It was Section 4 that was regarded unconstitutional. And so Congress, as ugly as it's looking right now in Congress, Congress has a chance, either this Congress or a future Congress has a chance to put together a new formula so that Section 5 can be restored to its former glory.
And that's Brenton Mock, who's a New Orleans-based journalist who serves as Colorline's reporting fellow on voting rights. We're also joined by Kate Kendall, who leads the National Center for Lesbian Rights here in San Francisco. And we're joined by Robert Rubin, who's a civil rights attorney. Robert, I want to get to you in just a moment, but I want to invite our callers to join our conversation. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about the historic recent decisions by the Supreme Court on DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, Proposition 8 here in California, and the Voting Rights Act, and comparing and contrasting these decisions and looking at how society is changing and the effect of the court's decisions on our culture. So if you have reactions to today's decision on legalizing same-sex marriage or yesterday's decision on the Voting Rights Act, give us a call at 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you have questions about these decisions and what they're going to mean in the future, give us a call, 866-798-8255. In both dissenting opinions on both of these cases, the dissenters accused the courts of overreach and stepping on another branch of government. What do you think is the ideal role of the Supreme Court, and how do you define judicial activism? 866-798-8255 is our number. And let me go to you, Robert Rubin. How are you looking at these two cases side by side? Robert, are you there? Did we lose Robert?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hi. Sorry about that. Yeah. How are you looking at these two cases?
Well, with different eyes. I guess to start with, I do want to congratulate my colleague Kate Kendall on some brilliant advocacy and their wonderful victory. It's time, and I'm glad that the court is even if reluctantly acknowledged that. So That's an unmitigated victory.
Thanks, Robert.
In terms of, I think I don't quite share the optimism of Brenton, although I did have an op-ed in Sunday's Chronicle predicting victory, so I guess my prognostication record is not particularly strong. But I have serious doubts that Congress will do anything about the elimination of the coverage formula that the court found unconstitutionally yesterday. I think that the debate would be somewhere, something along the lines of one senator saying to another, I'll agree that my state discriminates. If you agree, your state discriminates. That's a tall task. And I just don't know whether the Congress is up to it, despite the fact that they did vote 98-0 in 2006 to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. But I think that, fortunately, here in California, we do have a State Voting Rights Act, which is unique in the country, that allows us to fill in some of the holes that Section 5 might leave, but certainly not all of them. And Section 5 is, there's never been a more effective, more powerful tool in the civil rights advocacy world than Section 5. And that is because what it does is it shifts, I guess I need to start using the past tense, it shifted the burden of relief from the victims of discrimination to the perpetrators of discrimination. In that, if at the last minute, the state of Mississippi decided to move a polling booth from the NAACP headquarters to the White Citizen Council meeting hall, that would have to be challenged by the individual voter, who probably could not afford to file the challenge, nor would they even be aware of it until they showed up to the poll and found out that it had been moved. Under Section 5, that change in polling places, which has severe racial impact, would have to be pre-cleared, that is, approved by the Justice Department before it goes into effect. So that is a tremendous loss, and there's no way to minimize it.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Krennan. Let's get a question from our first caller, Lisa in Oakland. Welcome to Your Call.
Yeah, I just want to say I'm a lesbian feminist, and I have been saying for years now that gay marriage is a conservative issue. It is not the issue that feminists and progressive queers have been fighting for. And furthermore, it creates more inequality. It now creates a group of people who have special rights against those people who do not, i.e. single people, those of us who are single in the queer community. And furthermore, it is emblematic of how the mainstream gay movement has become racist and not representative of most queers. We don't even have an economic discrimination law. And we have lost funding to so many grassroots groups to gay marriage, when gay marriage was not even an issue that most queers wanted, statistically. That has been, in poll after poll, most gays are not concerned with marriage.
And Lisa, I'm going to stop you because we need to go to a break, and we'll get an answer to your question right after the break. I'm Holly Krennan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back.
KALW, we invite you to join in today's conversation. You can send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can join us live on the phone, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. By the way, tomorrow night, Eric Jansen's Out in the Bay will be a listener call-in special about the Supreme Court's rulings this week, what the decisions mean politically, and the impact they have on individual lives. Join Eric Jansen for Out in the Bay tomorrow night at 7 here on KALW.
Welcome back. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll ask, what does the Supreme Court's decision about same-sex marriage tell us about the place of gays and lesbians in our society now? And as events like SF Pride get major corporate support, are they changing in fundamental ways? And tonight, there will be an NPR special wrapping up the Supreme Court session tonight at 6 on KALW and KUSP, featuring NPR's Nina Totenberg. Today, we're examining this week's Supreme Court decisions. The court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act earlier today, ruling it unconstitutional because it violates the right of liberty and equal protection for gay couples. Yesterday, the court gutted the Voting Rights Act in many ways. So what do these rulings tell us about the state of civil rights today? Give us a call at 866-798-8255 to tell us your reactions to these rulings and your analysis. Also, any questions about what this means for our future and for our common civil rights agenda. 866-798-8255 is the toll-free number. And before the break, Lisa was talking about this decision on DOMA creating more inequality. And she says that same-sex marriage is a conservative issue and that the mainstream gay movement is really affecting the civil rights agenda in a negative way. Let's get you to respond first, Kate.
Well, I really appreciate Lisa's perspective. I mean, as a lesbian feminist myself, I do think that it's enormously important to not have any sort of gains come at the expense of those who are most vulnerable or who don't wish to participate in whatever, you know, whether it's the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell or winning marriage. My only disagreement with Lisa was that this was very much a grassroots push. Many of the organizations, this was way back in the mid-90s when I first started doing this work, many of the organizations themselves were not interested in pursuing marriage, but couples in states, beginning in Hawaii and then in many other states, overwhelmingly sought the right to marry. And we have seen, actually what we've seen, we do a lot of work, marriage is only a small piece of what we do at NCLR. We do immigration work, we do youth work, especially for youth in juvenile justice and foster care systems, sports and homophobia in sports, a lot of elder work and a lot of family work, especially for couples in states where they are economically marginalized. And our work on marriage, which was a small part of the work we do, helped to support all the rest of the work. And then the only other thing that I'll say is, as I, you know, I'll say again what I said earlier, this is not in any way the end. We have to look over our shoulder and recognize marriage is not right for every family structure. We have to have alternative family structures. There are many people who are being left behind as this march to equality happens, who live in states where they're protected, and then many people who live in states where they have zero protections. You know, we have to think about poverty. We have to think about race. We have to understand how those things intersect with sexual orientation and gender identity. And it's why I think this show, the way you've structured this show, you know, is so important, Holly, because voting rights, what the court did with Title VII, this sort of bowing down to corporate interests, even what they did with the Indian Child Welfare Act yesterday, there is a lot to be concerned about that came out of the court that is not at all in line with our values of humanity and decency and a broader, more progressive agenda. So we need to all, you know, be keeping our eye on the prize here and not thinking that any one victory means we're done.
Well, I wonder from both of you, is there a kind of coherency and consistency in terms of how this court is ruling? I mean, states' rights, Kennedy is the swing vote on most of these decisions. What do you see as kind of the how do you define this court and its decisions, especially this session?
Well, I do think that your point that there is some consistency around definitely very reverent for states' rights and wanting smaller government, federal government action, that is what killed DOMA for sure. But I think the court has made very clear that if there is a battle between, you know, corporate interest and individuals, corporate interest will very, very often prevail, even though Kennedy is somewhat more moderate, maybe on some of the civil liberties issues. But But that didn't happen with voting rights. And I think, you know, I've said this to a couple of folks in my observation in light of the victories today, that we have to be very careful that we don't win the battle and lose the war for what kind of country we're going to live in. I think this court is very conservative. I think it tacks away from protecting individual interests and civil liberties when that's juxtaposed against either state governmental interests or corporate interests. And that is something that should be concerning even in the face of, you know, celebrations of in any one particular ruling.
And Britton, let me get you also to weigh in on that question of the coherency and consistency of this court. Let me remind everybody, you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. I'm joined by Brenton Mock, who's a New Orleans-based journalist and serves as Color Line's reporting fellow on voting rights. Kate Kendall leads the National Center for Lesbian Rights. You can join our conversation about the Supreme Court rulings at 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. If you're affected by either of these rulings or any of those in this last term, let us know your experience, 866-798-8255. And if you have questions about what these rulings actually mean for the future of voting rights, gay and lesbian rights, same-sex marriage, etc., give us a call at 866-798-8255. And Brenton, let's go to you on that question of the coherency of the decisions of this court.
I don't think that there is any coherency, or none that I've identified. I think the only consistent person on there is probably Clarence Thomas, who's never seen a civil rights legislation that he completely hated to its bone. And other than that, I think they're all over the place. You know, last week the Supreme Court made a ruling on Arizona versus Intertribal Council of Arizona, which nullified Arizona's proof of citizenship law. And they did that by saying that Congress had broad authority to intervene when a state tried to pass a law that might compromise the voting rights of particularly of someone of people of color. Yesterday, they went back and decided that Congress just didn't have that authority, or at least that they could assert that authority. So I don't think that they listen much to the evidence before them. I think that a lot of them go in with prejudices against certain civil rights issues. And and as much as there was a victory today for marriage equality, I hold fast very much to Martin Luther King's quote that an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. That war definitely has to, you know, stay alive, and we can't, you know, get comfortable to that.
Is there a common civil rights agenda that crosses these platforms?
I think equal protection under the law and upholding the 14th Amendment is somewhat being catered to by these decisions. But I would argue that Voting Rights Act decision very much put the voting rights of a lot of Americans. I believe it's something like 2/3 of African Americans lived in states covered by the Voting Rights Act, Section 5. And I think that they do not have equal protections due to that decision.
And Brenton, did the Voting Rights Act decision surprise you, or were you ready for it?
Unfortunately, I was not surprised because of the prejudice of Chief Justice Roberts and of Clarence Thomas, Scalia also. It was almost clear to me that they were going to make this decision, and I wanted to be wrong so much, and I was hoping for a surprise like what we saw with the Affordable Health Care Act. But, you know, I wasn't surprised, but I have to keep a healthy dose of optimism. If I could push back on what my fellow panelists said a little earlier, while it was a bad decision, I have to hold on to whatever optimism exists because I'm an African American male. Last year, I didn't have a driver's license, so if I lived in a state that had a voter ID law, I would have been burdened by my right to vote. So I have no choice but to have some kind of slither of optimism in terms of my civil rights and my right to vote for a candidate of my choice in this nation.
And let's get to some more calls. Mike in Daly City, welcome to your call.
Hi, this has to do with the Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. I guess I kind of have two related questions. And number one would be why this would not result in all 50 states or all jurisdictions having to pre-clear any change that might be discriminatory. And the second question along the exact same lines is, why, if the Congress voted 98-0, wouldn't they pass some legislation along those lines if it's not already in effect that way?
And why don't we go to Brenton with that?
Yeah, I would say that it definitely does not trigger an automatic pre-clearance provision for all 50 states, because Congress literally has to create the new Section 4 coverage formula. So if someone proposed legislation tomorrow saying, hey, you know what, let's apply Section 5 to the entire nation, and then it passed, then, you know, that would be the case. But it definitely does not automatically kick in. The 98-0 Senate vote of 2006 obviously presented a completely different Senate than what we have now. The Senate of 2006 was the pre-Tea Party, pre-Tea Party Senate. I think now it would be very difficult for the Senate to come up with a completely new piece of legislation, not only because of the other priorities that it's competing with in terms of immigration reform, climate change, the budget, but also because I don't even know that the political will is there right now. Eric Cantor out of Virginia, he actually did call for Congress to come together and create a stronger Voting Rights Act. It's not reflecting the will of a lot of the state lawmakers. What we saw after the Voting Rights Act decision was a lot of the state attorney generals and secretaries of state in the previously covered states, such as Mississippi, Texas, North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, all of them said that they were going to immediately reinstate voter ID laws, redistricting laws, and other voter suppression laws that had been blocked by Section 5 protection.
And so, Brenton, if this decision had been made before the 2012 election, what might have been the effect?
It's really hard to say what the effect would have been. I mean, let's look at what Section 5 did directly impact in 2012.
Yeah.
It blocked Texas's redistricting plan. Texas put together a redistricting plan that would have packed a lot of its Latino voters into a very few amount of districts. The Section 5 review and the court, U.S. District Court hearing on that redistricting plan actually found discriminatory intent on the part of Texas lawmakers when they created that plan, and they blocked it accordingly. Same with the voter ID law that Texas passed. That was blocked by a Section 5 review, and it was found that hundreds of thousands of Latino and African-American voters did not have the ID required to be able to access their ballot. The law in South Carolina, they also found intentional discriminatory language that was proffered by South Carolina state legislators when they created the voter ID law, and the court review of the voter ID law, actually forced those lawmakers to modify their voter ID bill so that it would have a less disenfranchising effect. Same in Florida with the cuts to early voting. With Mississippi. Mississippi passed a voter ID law that was held up because of a Section 5 review that needed to come from the federal government. So, I mean, we may have, you know, last year was no, you know, cakewalk for a lot of people of color. A lot of them still faced barriers when they went to the polls, but had not Section 5 been in place, those barriers would have been even more insurmountable in order for them to get the vote.
And that's Brenton Mock. He's a New Orleans-based journalist, and he is the reporting fellow on voting rights for colorlines.com. We're also speaking with Kate Kendall, who leads the National Center for Lesbian Rights. We're talking about the recent Supreme Court decisions this week on DOMA, which was ruled unconstitutional, and on the Voting Rights Act. And if you'd like to join our discussion, we're at 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about the way that the Supreme Court ruled this week and in this session, and how it's going to affect us going forward? 866-798-8255. 8255 is our toll-free number. And we just you can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And this comes from Mikey. Question for my constitutional lawyer friends. Since I live in Oregon, if I go and get married in California, will I get federal benefits back home in Oregon? I know Oregon won't recognize gay marriages, yet I'm hoping there may be a roundabout way to get federal recognition. Kate, how does this new DOMA decision affect that?
Well, I think Mikey will get federal recognition. I mean, it's a little bit of an open question, and I'd need to actually have this definitively determined from the AG in Oregon. But if any state recognizes your marriage, even if they wouldn't marry you themselves, as long as they recognize your marriage. I mean, for example, the 18,000 couples who got married in California, or actually if you got married anywhere, the California AG and the governor said long ago that they would recognize the marriage for all state purposes of any couple who got married, even though with Prop 8, the state itself couldn't marry people. Oregon, I think, is very much along those same lines. I think there are many other states that are in that column where even though they themselves won't perform marriages, New Mexico is one of these other states, and there's a list of them, I can't think of them all right now, they will recognize a marriage validly performed somewhere else. And I'm sure Oregon is in that category. I'm 95% sure, Mikey. So that would mean that you will have all federal benefits and recognition that it would apply as if you had married in your home state.
Now, what if I live in a state that doesn't recognize same-sex marriages? Say I go across the lines, get married in California, but I'm from, say, Utah. Mm-hmm. What happens to me federally?
You will have only the federal benefits that look to the place of celebration of the marriage. That is the place that was solemnized, the place you got married. And there's some federal benefits, and it's all very complicated. We have a 200-page FAQ that we just released this morning.
And we'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org, along with more information about this. Go ahead, Kate.
I will shoot that to you, Holly, so that you'll have that, so that people can refer to that. You know, we started out this project thinking it was going to be a 15 to 30-page paper, and it ended up being super complicated. So for some things, the Obama administration can actually act, and by executive order, they can extend federal benefits. But some things like Social Security survivors benefits are by statute, and those can only be provided to couples if they live in a state that doesn't recognize their marriage, if there's some sort of congressional action, or if we get rid of these marriage bans. And so, you know, as I said earlier, there's still a long road to go here. And, you know, I totally agree with Brenton. I have tremendous optimism. I'm totally Pollyanna-ish in my approach. I think we're going to come to a day where, you know, no matter where you live, you know, you live free from stigma or discrimination based on who you love, the color of your skin, you know, your economic situation. And, you know, that's the world we strive for. And this Supreme Court term had some real setbacks to that vision. It had some positive signs. But, you know, that's the direction we're definitely rowing in, and there will be states where this is just going to have to be worked out through future litigation and policy advocacy.
And let's go to Terry in Oakland. Welcome to your call, Terry.
Hi. I have a question about those states that allow civil unions and domestic partnerships. And so, like, the couples have the rights of marriage in their states, like in New Jersey. How does the DOMA law apply to them? The DOMA ruling, rather.
Well, we very much think, and it is our position with the administration, that that DOMA federal benefits should apply to any of those relationships as well, in addition to marriages. And this is a little bit of a fine-tuning. What we actually need, those states that have civil unions and domestic partnership, what we need those AGs, those attorney generals in those states to do is say, look, not only do we recognize the civil unions and domestic partnerships, but we will recognize any marriage from any other state, and we are perfectly fine for these civil union and domestic partnerships to be accorded federal benefits. That is still an open question. We don't know exactly the answer to that, but our advocacy, and we're going to certainly push the administration to do this, is to allow federal benefits to attach. But keep in mind, this is one little wrinkle. A lot of folks who may be in civil unions or domestic partnerships do not want federal responsibilities and benefits because they, you know, they don't want that level of entanglement in each other's lives. So at some point, we're going to have to come to a place in this country where we have a different range of relationship recognition that doesn't even require a romantic relationship. It's just a relationship of mutually economically interdependent people who get certain benefits and recognition. You know, we're obviously, you know, a ways away from that. But I think we're on our way to recognizing multiple kinds of family forms. But to your key question about civil unions, you know, we're just going to have to wait and see. But our advocacy is that federal benefits should attach.
And let's go to Mike in San Francisco. Welcome to your call, Mike.
Hi.
Or Mick, sorry.
That's okay. Coming a little bit late to the show, so hopefully not redundant here. You know, like many, I was just absolutely stunned, not surprised necessarily, but very dismayed and demoralized by this Supreme Court decision about the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, I think that what really shocked me even more is ever since the 2000 swing and the judicial activism that gave Florida to George Bush and then the presidency, in many views, people view it illegitimately, we do not have a national dialogue around the issue beyond voter suppression, but of absolute hacking of the vote because we've turned our voting system over to private corporations with no transparency, where the central tabulators that count the votes are intellectual property and off-limits to independent auditors. So it's an absolutely shocking landscape, and the Help America Vote Act that came out of the 2000 debacle allocated billions of dollars in funds to privatize our voting system with no transparency. So, you know, 14 major universities have shown that these systems are totally vulnerable, totally hackable, and they most likely have been many, many times over. And we're not having any kind of national dialogue about this. I feel like we're walking in our sleep. And when I think of the Voting Rights Act, first and foremost, I think of my ability, my right to vote with total transparency and oversight, public oversight of that process. And it's not happening. Just two quick thoughts. I would say Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T, he writes all the time about this. And Brad Friedman, bradblog.com, are great resources for this. But we are absolutely idiotic if we're going to continue to not be able to throw these people out who are these activists redistricting, suppressing votes, usually on the right, and not talk about how we've privatized our computer, our voting system, to computers with no independent audit.
Mick, just because we're running on low on time, let me toss that to our panelists and get some final thoughts here. So Mick is talking about a national dialogue that we should be having about voting rights and what he considers to be an attack on them, not just by this recent Supreme Court decision, but by what he's calling the privatization of the mechanisms of voting. So let me go to you, Brenton, on that first.
I believe that there is a national conversation that has been building since the November elections last year. I know the NAACP, the Advancement Project, ACLU, even some of the labor unions like AFL-CIO and SEIU, I mean, they've definitely been pushing forward with keeping voting rights on our radars and making sure that we're aware that there are some things that need to be fixed, as the president himself said in his State of the Union address. And I think that his Obama's Presidential Election Commission, which is just really getting kicked off this week, is going to continue to expand that dialogue. And it's going to be up to us to tune in to that as they come up with new policies, and it's also going to be up to us to contact our senators and representatives to let them know what we want, and that's how the dialogue will be kept open.
Up to us to tune in and keep the dialogue going. And Kate, let me just get final thoughts from you. Sort of where in the Library of Historic Decisions do you place DOMA, and what's next on the Common Civil Rights agenda? We've got about a minute and a half.
Well, there's no doubt that these rulings today were landmark and historic in every sense of that word, even if they don't go as far as we wanted or weren't everything we wanted. And I think what they remind us, particularly coming after the ruling yesterday on the Voting Rights Act and some of the earlier rulings last week on Title VII, is that we're all in this together. And, you know, Brenton, referring back to Dr. King's words, you know, we have to internalize the truism that, you know, an injustice to anyone anywhere is an injustice to all of us. I mean, paraphrasing. And it's, we just have to know that we're all in this together. And a rising tide lifts all boats. And if we, you know, take whatever victories we get and move forward movement we get, and we join forces with others who are vulnerable or marginalized, and move the needle forward on a whole range of justice issues, we're going to live in a country that we deserve, and a country where we can really be proud, and where all people have dignity and live full lives with full security. We're closer to that day in some ways with these rulings, but in other ways we're a little bit farther away, and we just can't stop. We have to just keep on keeping on.
So this is a victory, but the battle is long.
Very well put. Thanks, Ollie.
And we're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Kate Kendall, who's Executive Director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights. Thanks so much for joining us, Kate.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Brenton Mock is a journalist for Color Lines. He focuses on voting rights. Thank you, Brenton.
Thanks so much for having me.
And tonight we'll be airing an NPR special wrapping up the Supreme Court session featuring NPR's Nina Totenberg. That's at 6 on KALW and KUSP. We'll put a link to more resources at our website, yourcallradio.org, including that fact sheet that Kate mentioned. You can also continue the conversation there. That's yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to everybody who called and emailed. Apologies that we couldn't get to all of them. We'll put a link again to web resources at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What does the Supreme Court's decision ruling DOMA unconstitutional tell us about the place of gays and lesbians in our society now? What does it mean for gay politics? In the Bay Area, gays and lesbians have had cultural and political power for a while. As events like SF Pride get major corporate support, are they changing in fundamental ways? And as GLBTQ people become more widely accepted, is the radical promise of gay politics being lost? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.